This is Law and Disorder.
Today in Law and Disorder, we speak with economics professor Rick Wolf on both the federal Obama budget and the state budget crisis.
As far as Rick is concerned, both Republicans and Democrats are two wings of the same bird. Austerity, but not higher taxes that can really make a difference.
We are pleased to have with us returning guest Chris Hedges to talk about his new book, Death of the Liberal Class. This scathing narrative cuts to the heart of how the corporate state has claimed the liberal class as one of its victims. Stay with us.
Michael, for a long time here, we've updated people on the Posada Carriles trial going on in El Paso, Texas. And of course, he was the known terrorist, supposedly, allegedly, more than allegedly, convicted of blowing up the plane that killed the entire Cuban fencing team in the 70s, and also was accused of, and admitted, being involved in the killing of an Italian tourist in Cuba in the 90s. He's on trial now for perjury because when he came into the United States, he lied about his background. So we've seen a turning point now in the case. What's going on? The trial is still going on.
Here's the turning point. He's also on trial for three counts of perjury on lying in the immigration form about his role in the murder of this Italian tourist in 1995. You'll remember the Cubans were trying to make some money and break out of their isolation after the fall of the Soviet Union by opening up their tourist industry, and Posada Carriles, who's a CIA-trained, American Army-trained, and explosives CIA agent, organized the blowing up of several hotels, a bus, and so on, to try to destroy the Cuban tourist industry, and blew up one hotel, fancy one, Mela, and killed this young Italian businessman. Well, he lied about that to immigration. And what's different now, and what's really a major turning point, in my opinion, is that the Americans have sought collaboration with and are working with the Cuban government. They've got the chief investigator on the murder of the Italian tourist in Texas with
right,
all
testified.
Of his records.
He's testified.
Now, contrast that to the Cuban Five case.
But wait, before you get up to that, because there's an interesting wrinkle happened on that. They have allowed now the Cubans to testify at the trial of Posada Carriles, which is incredible. It's the first time it's ever happened, really, since the 60s, since the revolution, probably, or almost since then. And one of the twists that came out is one of the Cuban investigators turns out, I think, to have been an intelligence agent for the Cubans.
Yes.
And so the people representing Posada Carriles said, we want his testimony barred. The judge thought about it for a day and said, no, I'm allowing that witness to testify.
Yeah, it was scary. We thought that there'd be a mistrial, but it's going on as we're speaking.
Okay, now you're drawing a link with the Cuban Five.
But here's the context. South Florida was the base for these terrorists for many years. When the tourist industry was attacked, the Cubans went to the United States and they said, this is illegal. We want to collaborate with you. Please help us. The United States turned its back and wouldn't help. Attacks kept going on. So the Cubans, out of desperation, sent five Cubans to Miami to infiltrate the terrorist network in Miami. They accumulated a huge dossier on these terrorists, and they gave it to Washington, and they said, here's what you need to do. Here are the people that are doing this. Pick them up, please. What did Washington do? They figured out from the dossier who the Cuban agents were, arrested them, and that's the Cuban Five.
Right.
They're currently rotting in prison on huge sentences, some of them for life.
So hopefully they'll convict Posada Carriles of perjury, and hopefully we will get somewhere. We haven't yet on the Cuban Five. There's one person who's doing life there, and that's really sad. Finally, we're seeing some activity on the case of Bradley Manning. You all remember Bradley Manning. He's sitting in some hellhole at Quantico, Virginia, under terrible conditions. He is the young soldier who allegedly turned over some of the material to WikiLeaks. Well, Bradley's been treated badly, and there's been very little attention paid to his case. I am happy to announce that a new advocacy fund has been launched. It's called the Bradley Manning Advocacy Fund.org. And the new organization will provide analysis on Bradley's case and disabuse the misinformation campaigns that have been rampant throughout this country. Go to that site and find out more about the amazing, remarkable, and troubling case of Bradley Manning.
We're joined today with returning guest economics professor Rick Wolf. A lot of his current writings and lectures can be found on his website, R.D. Wolf, with two Fs, rdwolf.net. In one of his latest articles, The Revenge of Trickle-Down Economics, Differences Between Democrats and Republicans, he says both are committed to a broken, corrupt system. Rick also points out that the U.S. government plans to spend about $3.5 trillion from the federal budget to shore up a dangerously slumped economy while collecting $2 trillion in for tax revenues, which will leave a deficit of $1.5 trillion. Meanwhile, the Democrats and the Republicans debate over spending cuts that are around $40 to $60 billion. Rick says the debate is inconsequential. When the federal budget's projected deficit of $1.5 trillion will carry an annual interest cost of $40 to $60 billion. We get an update on the budget, the current economic conditions in the United States, and discuss possible alternatives with Professor Rick Wolf. Rick, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks a lot for having me.
It's always great to have you on the show. And with what's going on now in Wisconsin, it's going to be especially interesting to get your take on it. And that's my question to you, Rick. What's the relationship between the Wall Street disaster of a couple years ago and the uprising in Wisconsin?
When the collapse of our economic system unfolded in the years 2008 and 2009, it immediately occasioned panic at the highest levels of both the business and political community in the United States, resulting in a unanimous decision to pour huge amounts of government money to salvage the economy, to try to avoid collapse. Part of that money was literally created at the Federal Reserve and shelled into the economy. And an even larger part of it was borrowed by the federal government to get the money to bail out large corporations like AIG, which was basically purchased, General Motors, which was salvaged from bankruptcy, and almost all the major banks of the United States who received wild amounts of money, including indeed many foreign banks as well. This cost a fortune that the government borrowed. And as the government continued to borrow huge record amounts that we've never seen except in wartime before, the question was never asked, gee, if the government is borrowing like crazy, how is it going to manage to pay the interest costs? How is it ever going to pay this money back? And what will happen as that problem arises? Well, here we are a couple years later, and the problem has arrived, because what the government now faces is rising costs to carry this debt, to pay for this debt. And the question is, gee, what are we going to do? Because the money we now have to spend to pay interest to those we borrowed from to save the economy, that money has to come someplace. Either we have to raise taxes on the mass of people, and in this country, nobody wants that.
Taxes are just off the table, right?
Right. Can't discuss it. So the only way to free up the money to pay for all the debts that the crisis caused is to cut spending to free money, to lay off people, to cut programs, so that money that's saved by doing that can be given instead to whom? To the people who lent to the United States government. And let's just review quickly who they are. In the United States, it's mostly large corporations and wealthy individuals who lent to the government. They're the ones who always do that. And the money they lent to the government, let's remember, is the money that the government didn't tax from them. So for them, it's been a wonderful situation.
They didn't pay taxes.
They didn't pay taxes.
Got more
money. They get to lend to the government, which gave the money back to them to bail them out of a crisis. At this point, if you had the time, we'd play the national anthem just to celebrate what a wonderful arrangement this is. Well, that didn't happen. That is, they didn't find a way to get around this problem. So now they have to pay this interest, and they're cutting the programs in order to free up the money. And then the only debate becomes, who do you cut? And that's what we see our Republicans and Democrats doing, debating over who you cut, how much, as if that were the only question. Since what's off the table is the question, gee, maybe you ought to tax the people who have become wealthier than ever over the last 30 years, who have profited from the stock market booms and the stock market recovery now, and who were bailed out by the government. You might say those folks owe a little bit back to bail us out of a national crisis. Not a word.
And, of course, the recent tax bill included,
right, A little effort, a small, modest effort to tax the highest bracket, to move it back to what it was from the 35% it is now to 39%. Not a momentous move. Even that was too much for Republicans and Democrats alike to get it through. Let me turn, though, to the issue of Wisconsin to answer Michael's question. At the level of state and local governments, the law is different from the law for the federal government. State and local governments are not allowed to borrow money for their ongoing budgets.
Yeah, they're worse off than you and me. We can borrow.
We can borrow, and the federal government borrows big time. States and cities are not allowed to.
But what are municipal bonds? Aren't those borrowing?
Yeah, but they only can be borrowed for specific projects, not for the general budget. They have to be projects of sewers and schools and
dormitories.
Like that. Capital projects, they're called, not for your operating budget. So they have a problem.
Whereas the U.S., the United States itself, just issues general bonds.
That's
like
right. No problem at all.
I got for my bar mitzvah when I was
a
kid.
That's right. You run for your operating, pay your teachers, pay your police officers, and so on. So here's what we have. In every state, not just Wisconsin, in every state, in every city, the economic crisis is again the key. Everywhere, cities and states are facing lower revenue, and since they cannot borrow, there's only two options left. They either have to tax corporations and the rich to make up for what the average person unemployed can't pay anymore.
Can't they just eat the rich? Isn't that what we said when we were kids,
in the 60s? That's a shorthand way of saying what I'm saying. They could tax the rich and corporations, which one state in the union has done, Oregon, but the other 49 haven't done it yet, or they can start cutting. What you have in Wisconsin is simply the extreme version of that. The governor of Wisconsin is doing aggressively what other governors in Ohio, in Indiana, in Tennessee, and right here nearby in New Jersey are also doing. Slashing expenditures every which way they can, punishing their political adversaries. If you're a Republican, you punish the Democrats, or vice versa. And what they're gone even further is trying to get rid of the only obstacle they think they face in terms of cutting, which are the unions of the workers whose jobs they're destroying. So you have everywhere a confrontation. But again, it's really important for Americans to understand that the decision to cut is a decision that is taken without even debating the alternative that's available, which is to tax the wealthy and the business community. And in case people are asking, gee, what about taxing them? Two little facts to remember. Over the last 30 or 40 years, the relative tax burden on corporations and the rich have dropped across the board in the United States dramatically. So all we would have to do to radically alter the picture is to bring taxes on wealthy people and the corporations back to where they were, not raise them above any historical level, just back to where they were, and the large part of the deficits at the local, state, and federal level would disappear.
Let me see if I got the where they were. Because when you and I were kids, for the highest bracket, they were in the 90% or 96% bracket. Is that
That's right? In the 50s and 60s, for example, which is not ancient history.
For you and me, it's pretty old.
The top income bracket in the United States was 91%. People who earned the most had to take the highest portion, not all of it, the highest portion, say everything over $100,000 or $120,000, and they had to give the government 91 cents out of every dollar over that amount that they earned. Even in the 1970s, it was at the level of 70%. Today, it's at the level of 35%. That's the maximum. So the wealthiest people have seen the most dramatic drop in their income tax. And if we just brought it back to where it was in the 70s, let alone where it was in the 50s and 60s, we would have a vast inflow from the people who could afford it the most, who have done the best over the last 30 years, and who have been the major beneficiaries of the government bailout since this crisis hit. So if ever there was a rational argument to go after those people to be able to get the government to bail us out, which they benefit from, and have them contribute just as much as they used to. And the irony of our politics is the greed and the power of the rich and the corporations is so obvious that they have gotten it not even to be debated. I have to go around the country explaining to people in countless forums that this option exists because the elected officials of the people act as if it weren't there. I'll give you another example. in our war, which was a national crisis, World War II is what I'm referring to, a national crisis, in the federal government, the corporate income tax brought to Washington 50% more in total than was taxed from individuals. It was thought that the war was so important that the corporate sector should contribute. And in gross, in aggregate, the corporate sector contributed 50% more than what individuals were asked to pay. What is the relationship between the corporate income tax revenues for the government and individual income tax revenues
today? I'm dying
to
hear this, actually. It's interesting.
4-1.
Wait, 4-1 in favor of?
Individuals pay 4 times more into the federal government than the entire corporate income tax. Instead of the corporations paying 50% more, they now pay 25% of what individuals do. That's the success of the corporations. If you put together the corporations shifting the tax burden from themselves to individuals, and what I told you a minute earlier, how individuals at the top have shifted it to individuals in the middle of the bottom, you understand what the last 30 years has been. Easing off of corporations, easing off of the rich, putting the mass of the tax burden on middle and lower incomes. Of course, we've had a tax revolt in America, but it's not because taxes are too high. It's because we've reallocated who has to pay, which makes the solution now not raising or lowering taxes, but changing who is paying and ending the absurdity in which our tax system has removed the burden from those who could most afford it and placed it on those who could least afford it. But that can't be discussed, because the power of those who could most afford it is to keep the discussion from even going there. All that the Republicans and Democrats are debating is how much to cut and who to cut. But the issue of whether to cut, which any economist would tell you is always there when you deal with a budget problem. Budgets have inflows as well as outflows. But we don't discuss it.
Staying on this subject in Wisconsin, we've had you on the show a number of times. And I remember last June you came back from France and you said they're going to be imposing all this austerity in France. But these various unions and political tendencies, even though they're opposite, are going to get together and they're going to bring down or at least have huge demonstrations in France. And we were bemoaning at the time, how is this ever going to happen? It's going to happen in England. It happened in maybe Italy or Greece. But nothing is happening here, despite what you're saying that has been going on in this country for 30 years. And now all of a sudden, in my view, all of a sudden, we see some incredible militancy by unions, public unions, in Wisconsin. What changed? Why is it all of a sudden? Is it just getting too hard? Is it something to do with the nature of the attack on the unions? What is it?
No, I think it is that the American people are finally discovering that what they thought happens elsewhere, what they thought couldn't or wouldn't happen here, has arrived. It's basically, here it is. This crisis, which has already damaged working people in countless ways, is now coming to their doorstep by saying, and by the way, in Wisconsin, remember that the unions have already accepted a major set of givebacks. They're really fighting mostly about losing their collective bargaining rights. They've
that
accepted
is losing
cuts
their union, if you
and losing their union
so
rights.
That's what I don't get. You're right. I've read that they've given back already any wage increases for the next 2 years,
oh,
whatever.
Oh, no, and they've taken cuts, and they've accepted a lot of things. It's when the governor not only got them to accept cuts, which they did, but told them he wanted them to give up their right to fight against future cuts, that finally you've pushed Americans too far. I think the people in Wisconsin understood that this isn't a one-shot deal. This isn't another little bite out of their situation. This is an open-ended give-back program that has no end in sight, and it finally brought it home that what's moving the people in Europe, and by the way, that hasn't stopped, a major confrontation between Greek working people and the government there. 30 people were injured. There was massive struggle in the streets. More is coming. The difference in Europe, just a footnote again, is, and it's really important, they have a political option. They have socialist, communist, green, anti-capitalist parties of all kinds, and they're pursuing action in the streets, but also gearing up to throw these people out who are doing the damage to them. Well, American workers have no such option, so they're moving into the streets because they have no political expression.
You anticipated my next question. I know that you and Stanley Aronowitz and others have been active in trying to pull together people to at least talk about political option other than the Republicans and the Democrats. What would you hope to accomplish?
Well, at first, you know, I used to give answers to this question about grandiose objectives in the future and so on. At this point, let me talk very concretely and use as an example the utter bankruptcy of the Republicans and Democrats at the federal level. We are running a deficit the current year of about $1.5 trillion. President Obama's newly announced budget for next fiscal year, which begins in October, is also going to have $1.5 trillion of deficit. Now, let's do a little simple math. If you run a deficit of $1.5 trillion this year and next,
we don't even know what that number is. So the simple math should start with how big is a trillion and a half? It's more than a billion, right?
$1,000 billion is a trillion.
Okay, $1,000 billion.
So you're $1,500 billion. Wild amount of money. The interest charge that the government will have to pay next year for the deficit this year is about $50 to $60 billion. The entire debate between the Republicans and the Democrats, when all the dust clears, will lead to cuts in various programs of $50, $60, $70 billion. So let me be clear. What they're going to cut is going to be immediately offset by the extra expense the government has to pay interest on a deficit that neither party is challenging. The Republicans are making great theatrics. We're going to cut $100 billion. But out of a $1.5 trillion deficit, that's nothing. That doesn't make any difference. And the Democrats are holding back. They only want cuts of 50 or 60. This is a debate about nothing that will have no effect on anything that the government does. We have two political parties performing an obvious theater that has no relevance to the actuality that they're dealing with. The fact is, Republicans and Democrats alike accept that the government is not going to tax more than $2 trillion, roughly.
And that's how much our tax income is in the United States.
That's income on corporate tax, right, individual tax, all the rest. They're going to spend $3.5 trillion. The Republicans and Democrats do not disagree about that. They're both absolutely in favor of these mammoth deficits. They spend all of their time, we pay them, debating over trivialities. They're debating over a sum of money that will make no difference at all, because there is no disagreement on the large picture, which is bail out the big corporations, don't tax the rich, put the burden on the mass of people, keep borrowing like there's no tomorrow. That they all agree on.
No, it's true. I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying about trivialities. The only perspective I would like you to address is, yes, it's trivialities in terms of the deficit. It's trivialities in terms of they're not going to tax the well-off or the corporations. But the cuts of $60 billion on the Democratic side, or maybe $100 on the Republican, that's going to be cut from somebody somewhere. And it's not going to be cuts in our defense budget.
Absolutely. The defense budget is off the table. All the big programs are off the table.
Even though we're talking about a minor cut.
Right. You know, in the end, the compromises will be such that even the big theatrics you hear about today are going to be whittled down to nothing. Mainly, the Republicans are pandering to their base. They're going to go after the public radio. They're going to take away the subsidy. And the Democrats are going to protect pregnant women's nutrition program. Mm-hmm. This is theater. For an actual pregnant woman who may lose her benefits is, of course, very real and very tragic. And to do away with public radio, or to at least hamper them even further, would be a terrible law. Of course, there will be hurt people, but they are, as our government likes to refer to it, collateral damage to a theater in which there's no disagreement at all. No objection from Republicans or Democrats about the last 2 or 3 years of deficit spending that has kept our unemployment at 10%, that has made this year's housing foreclosure rate the highest we've ever had in this crisis.
That was amazing when I read that. And housing prices have gone to the lowest they've been since the crisis.
And we're now in a double dip. You know, we used to worry about a double dip. In the housing market, we've had a double dip. Since already October, November, housing prices have headed back down again with all kinds of consequences. The chaos in the Middle East is going to make the price of gasoline go over $3.50 a buck this summer regular gas. That's going to eat into the recovery for the mass of people. So we haven't solved the problems of the American economy. We have a three-year program of Bush and 2 years of Obama that has not worked. And the Republicans and the Democrats are doing it again and again. And there's no disagreement. There's no quarrel. The first thing a new party has to do is explain to the people that we don't have a two-party system. We have a one-party system with the two players in the one party wearing different hats, but they do not disagree about the program. to have a real two-party system, there has to be a new party with a different program.
Now, you say that, and I understand that we've always talked about that, and we always want that, and I know you're working on it, but what's happened in Wisconsin with finally seeing at least some backbone to public sector unions, how will that play into this, and do you feel hopeful about that, whether Wisconsin, Ohio, or other places, or will it be essentially bought off like they have been in the past?
You know, that's anybody's guess. I wish I could give you some reason to hope. It is interesting that the reaction of the mass of people, including union members, exceeded, and I know this for a fact from my own friends in that state, what the union leadership expected, what the Democratic Party, everybody's a little bit taken aback and trying to figure out where this is going and where it's coming from.
Right, I'm sure this is scary. This is scary for the Democrats and Republicans both, I would think.
This is an out-of-control situation for them. They expect passivity, and they are running around like chickens with the proverbial head removed, much as the European politicians have been doing for the last 18 months. So I think we don't know. Nobody knows exactly what to do. It is interesting that the Democratic Party in Wisconsin felt the need not to behave as usual. They literally had to leave the state so that the state police could not escort them back
to Illinois.
They went to across the state lines, but this is an unusual act.
Very unusual.
And it's a sign that the Democrats, at least in that state, are afraid to not at least appear to be. But here's my guess. I hope I'm wrong, but here's my guess that the Republicans and Democrats will make a compromise. And the compromise will leave most of the public employees in Wisconsin significantly worse off than they were up until now. That's going to slowly percolate into everyone's consciousness. And there's going to be a significant number of public employees who will conclude with some justice, if this compromise happens, that the Democrats didn't defend them. And at that point, they are going to be asking the same question millions of other Americans are asking, which is, is nothing going to help us? Is there nobody who's going to be able to stand up and offer an alternative? Since I can show as an economist, and any economist worth his or her salt could, that there are options and that those options would leave the rich very rich just a little less than they are now, and that that could avoid hurting a awful lot of people, it becomes a moral as well as political question. Why aren't you doing that? And when you have morals and politics working together, it's a powerful political combination. And even with a system rigged against new parties, you might be surprised at what happens here. Anti-capitalist parties came out of nowhere in Europe over the last 5 years and are now important players in Germany, in France, and increasingly in other countries. The idea that it can't happen here is as silly as the idea that mass demonstrations couldn't happen here. Wisconsin has taken the lead in showing us that was wrong, and the same may happen politically, and there are more and more voices in the United States who hope for that.
Rick, I'm holding in my hand two photographs that my sister Patty Elson sent me. She lives in Madison, and she was at all the demonstrations. And one of them is a woman holding up a sign that says, Egypt, Tunisia, Wisconsin, power to the people. And the other one says, what would Howard Zinn do?
Well, there was an interesting photo I saw of a demonstrator in the streets of Cairo holding up a handwritten sign, a woman, and the sign said, we support Wisconsin. So it's, you know, the internet allows a speed of solidarity to develop. But I would caution people. There are events now in at least 7 different countries in North Africa and at least 6 different states in the United States. This is spreading fast.
No.
Tennessee, New Jersey, Indiana, and Wisconsin, at least those that I've heard already about. And the biggest events in the Middle East are now in countries that are not Tunisia and Egypt, but Libya and Yemen and so on. It's extraordinary what's happening.
No, we're at a remarkable moment. I think,
yeah. And I think
we had you
crisis
in here a few weeks ago. Yeah. It was like a quietude, and now all of a sudden.
And it's all, to go back to Michael's earlier question, it's all that economic crisis. You know, you were squeezing people beforehand in many situations, including our country. It's a 30-year process that we're coming to the end of squeezing masses of people and moving wealth upwards to a smaller and smaller number of people. When you add to that long-term process a sudden serious crisis, you're pushing the people in the middle and the bottom over the edge. In Cairo, it was clear that rising food prices...
Right, commodity prices have been very important.
If rising food prices are the case, if signs say all we can afford to eat are cucumbers, which they had in Egypt, it means you are already having people at an edge which they can't handle another 10 cents a pound for grain or for vegetables. That's not a sign that the problem is the price of those things, which is bad enough. It's the problem that the basic economic condition is intolerable.
Spectacular and amazingly great explanation. Good. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much again for the opportunity and for having a program that does something to remedy the absence of a real, honest engagement with this country's problems.
Thanks, Rick Wolf, for being on Law and Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Pleased to have with us returning guest Chris Hedges to talk about his new book, Death of the Liberal Class. This scathing narrative cuts to the heart of how the corporate state has claimed the liberal class as one of its victims. Chris calls the liberal class ineffectual and out of touch with reality by not acknowledging that corporations have wrested the power from citizens. The death of the liberal class means there is no check to the corporate apparatus designed to enrich a tiny elite. The book lists the pillars of the liberal class that have been bought off with corporate money, such as the media, the churches, universities, the Democratic Party, as well as the arts and labor unions. Chris describes these harsh realities and sets them against the functions of a healthy liberal class in a traditional democracy. Welcome, Chris, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
The title of your latest book, and it's a really good read, and I would encourage people to get Death of the Liberal Class, is intriguing. What were the institutions that liberals were involved in that are dying, and why?
Well, the pillars of the liberal establishment, liberal religious institutions, labor, public education, especially public universities, culture, the press, and finally the Democratic Party, which made incremental or piecemeal reform possible, which watched out for the interests and the grievances of those outside of the narrow power elite no longer function. The term neoliberalism or neoliberal is really a kind of reconfiguring of what it means to be a liberal in a democratic society. We have figures like Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Pelosi and others who continue to speak in the traditional language of liberal values and yet have betrayed every one of those values. The unfettering of the marketplace, the subservience to Wall Street, the slavish catering to the permanent war economy, the failure to defend basic civil liberties, including habeas corpus, or to prosecute war crimes such as torture. All of these have been embraced so that a liberal is ultimately, on the sort of core structural issues, indistinguishable from a conservative. And you can put Thomas Friedman's columns next to David Brooks's columns and see exactly what I mean. And the battles to quote Freud, are really over the narcissism of minor difference.
One thing I thought was interesting when you talk about liberal and liberal class is the double role you saw it playing. One was to do, as you said, slight reforms, whatever term we want to use, but also was to legitimate the ruling power. And so it had this duality to it. And why don't you just talk about that for a minute, because it's something I hadn't thought about in the way you put it in your book.
Well, the liberal class or liberal institutions are traditionally allowed to function in a capitalist democracy because when there is a crisis within the society, they provide a formal channel or mechanism within the power structure by which injustices can be alleviated. The perfect example is the New Deal, which was not brought to us by great white liberals, but by sit-down strikes and bonus marchers and a resurgent Communist Party, and the liberal establishment embodied in figures like Henry Wallace, who was the vice president for Roosevelt, as well as Roosevelt himself, was able to create the New Deal and create regulations which inhibited the ability of corporate power to rape the country. That's a perfect example of how the liberal class functions, and Conrad Black, in his biography of Roosevelt, is right. What Roosevelt was not a traitor to his class, quite the opposite. Roosevelt saved capitalism. Now, with the rise of the corporate state, they fail to understand the importance of liberal institutions and the liberal class in giving credibility to and maintaining the power structure itself. They have corporatized all of the pillars of the liberal establishment, which I mentioned, the press, universities. Labor has been destroyed, and we are seeing the last readout of labor being decimated, public sector unions. I live in the state of New Jersey. This is the governor here, Chris Christie, has made war on the teachers' unions, although Cuomo is doing the same thing in New York. And there you go, a Democrat and a Republican embracing the same ideology. What kept the liberal class honest, I think, were these powerful populist progressive movements, which held fast to moral imperatives, communists, socialists, anarchists. And I go all the way back in the book to World War I because that, as to quote Dwight MacDonald, was the rock on which these movements broke. The rise of the Committee for Public Information, known as the Creel Commission, was the first system of modern mass propaganda and was put in place by Wilson, who I think comes across as a very dark figure in American history.
I agree.
To propagandize the country to support the war, which had no popular support at all. It was a war that was pushed upon us because bankers had lent tremendous sums to the British and the French, and they knew that if the Germans won the war, they would not be paid back. You then have the passage of the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, but it is actually not used very much. It's used against those few holdouts, like The Masses, which was a socialist publication, is shut down. Eugene Debs, of course, eventually the leader of the Socialist Party, ends up in prison, but it's used selectively. But what happens, and again, MacDonald writes about this, I think, quite presciently, is that everything shifts within American society because you enter a culture of kind of permanent war psychosis. The dreaded Hun is instantly replaced with the dreaded Red. And these progressive populist forces are broken and liberal institutions disemboweled by the witch hunts that takes place within them, the ACLU. And, of course, we saw the breakdown of capitalism in the 30s, a slight resurgence of these movements, and then the horrible Red Scare after World War II, which decimated what was left these movements. And so you had thousands of university professors, social workers, high school teachers, government officials, journalists, who became, including like I.F. Stone, becomes a pariah. He can't even get a job at The Nation magazine and ends up printing I.F. Stone's Weekly in his basement. A lot of these people, of course, had nothing to do with the Communist Party. And so the destruction of these populist radical movements, coupled with the kind of internal purging carried out primarily by careerists, people like Sidney Hook and others, really took away from us the mechanisms by which we could fight back. And with the gradual kind of coup d'etat in slow motion that the corporations have carried out in the United States, we're left powerless. We have no mechanism to fight back. And just one other point, going back to that Creel Commission, not only were they very astute in terms of all the mediums they employed to disseminate propaganda, but these people had studied very closely mass psychology, as it had been investigated by Le Bon, Trotter, and finally Freud.
And Freud's nephew. And
Edward Bernays was Freud's nephew twice over. And so they understood that people were not moved primarily by fact or reason, but could be manipulated through emotion, what Walter Lippmann's 1922 book Public Opinion calls manufacturing dissent. And well, these people went straight from the Creel Commission to Madison Avenue to work both for government and for corporations. And this is the result. We live in a society utterly saturated with lies.
We're talking with Chris Hedges. The book is Death of the Liberal Class. Chris, can you talk a bit about how, with the influence of corporations, the liberal class does not want to lose its well-paid status, and you know, professors earning up to $200,000 a year, labor leaders, and also how universities no longer teach critical thinking?
I mean, the liberal class has been reduced to the status of courtiers. They have economically, at least up until now, not suffered the same deprivation that has been visited on the working class, and increasingly the corporate state is rapidly reconfiguring American society into a form of neo-feudalism, where you have these speculators on Wall Street earning $900,000 an hour, and families of four barely able to feed and sustain themselves and forget the ability to pay medical bills. The elite institutions of education, which charge astronomical sums, my son is at one of them, $52,000 a year, essentially provide education for the elite while we gut public education. But the larger point, both within the elite institutions, and I've taught at some of them, Princeton, Columbia, NYU, is that everything is vocational. In the for-profit universities, which are the largest sort of growing sector within the education establishment, you don't even teach the liberal arts. You don't teach critical thinking. People are trained to work as cogs within the corporate structure. Inner city schools are turned into boot camps. That's what charter schools are about, and along with, of course, the ability to break teachers' unions. And everybody has their place. It solidifies a kind of caste system, and there's no hope of escape, or almost no hope of escape, although we're, of course, fed endless stories about the few exceptions to somehow make us think that we're responsible for our own predicament. This has been one of the most vicious things that's been visited on the working class in this country.
Chris, one of the really important points I think you make in the book that I hadn't thought about at all was when you talk about the death of the liberal class and these institutions, and of course, co-optation or cooperation with the corporate class is another way to look at the death. But you talk about then what happens in this vacuum, that there's no longer these liberal institutions that have reforms and the whole country is really, they're absent. And then you talk about really what happens, who fills that vacuum. And just talk about that a little bit, because that is some explanation for what's going on in the country right now.
Well, the liberal class traditionally is tolerated by the power elite, or was, because it castigated radicals. I mean, the figure that I think liberals hate most, and I can tell you this with some authority, having spent 15 years at the New York Times, is not Glenn Beck, it's Noam Chomsky. Because he calls out their collaboration with the power elite, the limits that they impose and that they won't cross. When the liberal class doesn't work anymore, you in essence turn that safety valve off. That possibility for limited reform no longer works, which of course is the problem. It's how we get absurdities like something called a job bill that ends up being $15 billion in tax credits for corporations. It's how we can stand by passively as 3 million people are forced from their homes through foreclosures and bank repossessions last year and another 3 million this year and do nothing. The danger is that as these grievances mount, there is no mechanism within traditional structures of power or traditional institutions by which these injustices can be ameliorated. And so they become expressed, and they are being expressed, in these kind of very frightening proto-fascist movements, such as the Tea Party militias, or through demagogues such as Glenn Beck or Sarah Palin and others, who give legitimacy to this anger and rage and sense of betrayal. And I would argue that the rage, the sense of betrayal, is legitimate, is real. These people have a right to be angry, and they have a right to feel that they have been betrayed. They have been. Unfortunately, part of their anger is directed not only at government, and of course very cleverly deflected away from Wall Street, but at liberals. And I think not wrongly. I think liberals, the hypocrisy of the liberal class, the hypocrisy of figures like Clinton or Obama, is readily apparent to those on the lower end of the economic spectrum, who hear these people speak one way and yet act another. In some ways, that increases the rage towards liberals. Now, the political agenda that is always put forward by these movements is irrational, as the Tea Party agenda is. The idea that, you know, we want government out of our lives, but don't touch unemployment benefits, Social Security, Medicaid, or Medicare. The idea that, you know, we want to not touch the military, as if the military is not part of government. And of course, it consumes half of all discretionary spending. It doesn't actually make any sense, but it provides an acceptable emotional outlet. And unfortunately, those who manipulate these emotions, while a liberal class loses touch completely and continues to speak in the kind of dead language of policies and issues, those who manipulate this seek scapegoats. It's the old story. I watched it in the breakdown of Yugoslavia. Suddenly, the Kosovar Albanians or the Muslims or the Croats become the reason for your economic distress. And remember, the war in Yugoslavia was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia, not by ancient ethnic hatreds. And we're seeing the same thing here, so that you have undocumented workers, Muslims, liberals, homosexuals. All of these people become convenient targets, lightning rods for the rage and violence that is sort of bubbling up from the bottom of American society. And that is the danger of the collapse of a liberal class, because when these liberal institutions, when these mechanisms for reform are shut tight, or when they ossify and die, then the anger is expressed and manifests itself in very frightening forms.
Chris Hedges, author of Death of the Liberal Class, that was really powerfully said. I thought that your time at the New York Times and your relating that story to our listeners would be very worthwhile. Can you tell us what happened there? You were really one of the jewels in that newspaper, and all of a sudden you're not writing for them anymore. How do you fit your own personal story into this whole narrative about the death of the liberal class?
Well, there are very clear lines. They're not written or published, but if you reach any kind of position of responsibility within these institutions, you learn what those lines are, and you don't cross them. I interview Sidney Shanberg in the book because he's a good example of somebody who did cross them. He began writing about what developers were doing in New York, and that did not please his editors or the publisher, and he was eventually pushed aside to the Village Voice. In my own case, it was a matter of, and I had spent 7 years in the Middle East. I speak Arabic, a lot of time in Iraq. Had published a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which put me sort of on the circuit. And I would end up on shows like Charlie Rose and others, and I would be asked about the impending build up for an invasion into Iraq, which I denounced, as I think all Arabists did, even those in the State Department and the intelligence community and the Pentagon. We knew that it was a fantasy-driven enterprise, the idea that we were going to be greeted as liberators or that democracy would be implanted in Baghdad and emanate out across the Middle East, or that the oil revenues were paid for the reconstruction, was not a reality-based belief system. And yet to say that, and I think sometimes we forget how popular that war was tantamount to professional suicide. I'd been there long enough to know that I was doing, and I continued to speak out and was eventually booed off of a commencement stage in Rockford College in Rockford, Illinois, where the crowd got up and started singing God Bless America and cut my microphone twice. And the trash talk shows got a hold of the home movie footage and looped it. You know, they just ran it over and over and over, and they lynch you in the same way they lynched my friend Jeremiah Wright, or they turn, I think, very those few lonely figures like Ralph Nader or Kucinich who get up and speak into figures of ridicule. And the paper was forced to respond because of the public outcry by the right wing. And the way they responded was to issue me a formal written reprimand for impugning the impartiality of the New York Times. In essence, we're gilled. So they give you a written warning, and then the next time you violate that warning, you can be fired. And, of course, I knew that I had a choice. I could muzzle myself in service to my own career, but to do so would be to betray, I think, everything, every value system that I held, and so I left the paper. I think that those, you can find people within these institutions who are driven by a very real concern for those outside the power elite and seek to give expression to their suffering and pain and those injustices, but they, those people don't often last within those institutions.
Chris, that allows me to segue into something that we're all eager to hear you talk on, and that's what's going on in Egypt today and by extension the rest of the countries that have been affected by the huge rebellion in Egypt. And with respect to the impartiality of the New York Times, we've all been reading the Times, among other news sources. What's your take on how the Times is covering the United States' reaction to what's going on in Egypt and what's really going on in Egypt?
And you actually were reporting from Egypt for a number of years for the Times, is that right?
Yes. Well, the problem with, and I wouldn't say this is just the problem with the Times coverage, I think it's almost across the board, is that every time there are popular demonstrations against a dictator, we paint the opposition as if they're us. I saw that in the opposition to the street demonstrations against Milosevic. The Serbs leading the street demonstrations, including the students, were nationalists. They brought the Archbishop of the Serbian Archbishop to march with them, but not the Imam or the Catholic Cardinal. And I think that this is part of the problem in the way we cover the uprising or the rebellion in Egypt, is that we paint the opposition as if they're us, and they're not us. Egyptians have their own history, their own sets of concerns. Over half of the Egyptian population, a country of 80 million, are desperately poor, struggling on less than $2 a day. There is tremendous popularity for Islamic movements, especially the Muslim Brotherhood, but even other more radical movements. The collective humiliation that Egyptians and most Muslims feel over the presence of American troops on Muslim soil, and not just in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in the staging areas like Doha or Kuwait or Saudi Arabia, is deeply angering. The capitulation to Israel, the failure to stand up for the Palestinians, and remember the Mubarak regime is openly collaborates with Israel because it closes off the southern border of Gaza, essentially participating actively in the siege that is imposed upon Gaza. All of these things color the vision of the opposition, and I think that with the breakup of the Mubarak regime, as well as many of these bankrupt secular regimes, which have sold out to Western interests and refused to stand up for basic concerns within the Muslim and the Arab world, we are inevitably going to see a shift towards a government that has a much more pronounced Islamic coloring, even if Mohamed al-Baradei, who has no real base within Egypt, ends up being a transitional figure. I think part of the reason the Muslim Brotherhood is so happily to embrace it is because they know in the end that they will walk away if there is a democratic opening with a significant amount of power. And I really think this is the result of the inability on the part of the United States to deal with any kind of vision or justice towards the Arab world. And they, along with their ally Israel, have traditionally believed that they can speak to the Muslim street exclusively in the language of a force and power. And that is, I think, backfired on them. And you know, what we're going to see if there is not a radical shift in the way we and Israel relate to the Arab world is a rise of Islamic states that will essentially sort of act as a kind of noose around Israel. And because of our response, the result is that we radicalize it further and further and further, as we've seen with the Palestinians.
I mean, I think that's interesting about the Muslim Brotherhood, because I consider myself at least a relatively wide reader and knowledgeable, and yet I really didn't have a sense of who they were. And if you talk to people on the street, they look at them as if they're al-Qaeda. And, of course, if you go to the Muslim Brotherhood website, they're against al-Qaeda. And
yeah, well,
and
no, a lot of people don't know that al-Qaeda not only hates the Brotherhood, but they've declared Hamas as apostates because they negotiated with the Israelis through intermediaries in Cairo. Everything gets, it's like communism, you know, as if Yugoslav communism is the same as East German communism. It's not. And having spent 7 years in the Middle East, you see these variations. And also you understand that these groups, especially the Brotherhood, is a very established party. Now, it is not going to be a slave to American or Israeli interests. But if you crush the Brotherhood, you will get radical configurations that I think are much more frightening. This is kind of self-fulfilling prophecy to American and Israeli policy in the Middle East.
Chris, let's come home for a bit, because I wanted to give you a chance to speak about your notions about what people, like the people that listen to Law and Disorder, what people like us should be doing now in the wake of this death of the liberal class. When you go out and speak, what do you advocate in terms of people say, what should we be doing?
I think it's imperative upon all of us who care about protecting civil society that we begin to engage in acts of civil disobedience, because we are the last thin line of defense between a complete collapse of society. And remember, the undercurrent of violence in American culture runs very deep. It's not a joke when these Tea Party people bring their guns and celebrate the gun culture at their events. It's not funny. The fact is that we live in a system that no longer cares to concern itself with the needs or rights of citizens. And the only weapon we have left is our physical acts of, in my case, nonviolent defiance.
And I think recently you actually were arrested. Is that right, Chris?
Yes.
And where was that?
In Washington with mostly veterans, 131 veterans, Daniel Ellsberg among them, denouncing the war and a rally against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think that it's extremely important that we stop living within the illusion that we're going to reform the Democratic Party or that any of these institutions are going to come to our aid. All of them have been hollowed out. All of them have been destroyed. None of them are going to take a stand at a moment, I think, that a very precarious moment in American history. We who, I think, see it have a kind of responsibility as citizens to, as much as we can, jam sticks into the cogs of the machine.
The old saboteur word, right? When they put shoes in the machinery, right, Chris?
That's a good way to go.
But Chris, we really appreciate it. Every sentence you say is just really, I think for all of us sitting here, it's just so meaningful and important. And the book is a really fine book. It just explains much more than I think any of us were able to explain without this book. We're speaking with Chris Hedges, Death of the Liberal Class. And again, Chris, thank you for all you've done and all you're going to do.
Thanks, Mike.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.